Welcome to Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here is the podcast host, James Dellingpole.
This is being recorded at the Birmingham Conservative Conference, which will probably have happened several weeks ago by the time you hear this. I'm not sure when it's going to go out. But I've just sat on this panel talking about cryptocurrency regulation, about Bitcoin and stuff. And one of my fellow panelists was this amazing guy who I didn't know nothing about, actually. What I've discovered while I sat on the panel is he knows loads of really interesting stuff. His name is Craig Wright. He is the chief scientist at a company called Enchain. And you've done pretty well out of cryptos, haven't you, Craig?
I've definitely done pretty well. The way I look at it, I like to see sort of the ability to create wealth as a reward that, well, not so that you can retire and live on a boat or something like this, but as a way of allowing you to direct how the future might happen along some of the things that you've been creating.
Mm. Take me back to the very beginning. At university, what did you study? Computing?
Oh, which time? My first sort of entry into university was in the late 80s, where I studied computer systems engineering and computer science. But that's a long time ago. I'm sort of working on my fourth doctorate at the moment. So I haven't actually made it out of university either.
But basically, you come from the kind of background, which means you're probably not going to end up slumming it as a journalist. You were always kind of destined to do something techie. But did you know you were going to make it really, really big?
Oh, one always hopes, but no, I didn't know. I came from a very poor family. I mean, I had a single mother who worked four jobs, etc. So, a lot of why I'm industrious is watching my family have to work to actually survive.
Right. Okay. From Australia, presumably.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, which part?
I originally started in Brisbane, which is up in Queensland. So up in the north. And later on, in the 90s, I moved down to Sydney.
Right. There's a man outside who wants to use his photocopier. It's fine. Don't panic. How did you get into the whole Bitcoin world? I mean, you're presumably very, very early on in the game.
I've been involved in the whole Bitcoin world the whole time. I've been involved in the nature of security and cryptocurrencies since the 90s. I met Tim May back in the early 90s, and although we have some very different ideas of sort of philosophy of all this, we have some overlaps and parallels as well. So Tim would have been a lot more like you, I guess, the crypto anarchist, whereas right. I'm the terrible business economist type, companies a good person, and small government, but allow companies to get on with it.
Right, yeah. So, well, yeah, Tim sounds fun. Is he, what's he doing now?
Last I heard, he's in a university over in California.
Right.
Basically, trying to knock knowledge into silly people who'd rather take drugs.
Oh, okay, yeah. I know that scenario. So they say, don't they, that all these great inventions. I mean, if it wasn't just Edison who discovered the light bulb, there were lots of people sort of who invented it about the same time, and he was just.
Oh, actually, it goes back way before then. There are a number of light bulb inventions that go 30 plus years before Edison. The difference was Edison sat there and made one that was economically viable.
Right.
So he did the 10,000 different experiments until he found one that worked.
So in the same way, cryptocurrencies were just waiting to be invented. Blockchain technology was just waiting to be developed, and you were one of the first people in on the act.
So really what it's about is the concept of economic security. That's what many people don't like, but Bitcoin, distributed ledger technology, blockchain, whatever you want to say, works because there is an economic value to the token.
Yes. You mentioned, I was kind of pleased about that, because there were some people at the conference this morning that clearly wanted to kind of divorce the whole business from money.
Yes, there's always that. Unfortunately, there are people who like this idea of everyone being equal, but Let's take the old sort of experiment as a thought experiment. Let's say we have everyone equal, but there's a Michael Jordan appears, and everyone's willing to pay 25 cents to Michael Jordan to see him play, and a million people come and watch him. And he does that 100 times, and suddenly he's got a lot of money, more than everyone else. Do we redistribute that again because someone was successful? Or do we sort of take pride in the fact that we've got this one person here that is delivering what everyone wants?
Yeah. And I've always thought that also applies to things like good looks and the amount of sex that you get. The people who are going to get more sex, aren't they, on account of their being hot or buff or whatever?
Well, I guess so, yes.
So we're not going to get this. We're not going to get this equal world. But so, yeah. So I understand that the reason that blockchain works, the reason that distributed ledger technology works, is because it is in people's financial interests to mine this increasingly complicated technology. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. And because they get paid in a token that has financial value, more people will then mine, and it comes to a equilibrium. Not that everyone on Earth runs a node or some silly thing like this, but that effectively a lot of competing organizations do this. And what they then have to do is make the access faster, make the onboarding easier, and allow more and more people to use the token. It's a typical capitalist environment. And in doing that, in growing their platform, those competing miners will have more and more money coming in. But at the same time, as you get more people competing, only the best ones survive. And that's a good thing. I know many people don't like the whole concept of corporations having to fight for survival and some going bankrupt, but that way you actually get competition that grows an industry.
Yeah, it's creative destruction, isn't it?
It is.
We know, of course, that loads and loads of the cryptos, Ripple, Neem, whatever, Dogecoin. Is Dogecoin even going still? I don't know. But
I'm not even sure. It's got the dog still, but more than that, I don't know.
But lots of these currencies are gonna fall on their ass in the end, aren't they?
Well, I mean, the one I sort of made fun of at a conference earlier this year was the sex industry coin, which I made fun of by calling hooker coin. Now, the reason for that is if you're talking about a currency that is focused on something, I imagine a money, a note that you take out of the bank that's only allowed to do one thing. Now, why would you want that? I mean, you go back home, you talk to your wife and go, honey, I just bought hooker coin. What's she going to say? Did you invest it? No, I spent it.
Yeah. Knowing wives, that you wouldn't even mention your hooker coin. You just wouldn't.
Exactly.
Some things a chap cannot tell his wife, and that would be one of them.
Yes, we've got a large investment in hooker coin, honey. Yeah.
But so that also applies to, because weren't the coins designed to buy drugs as well?
All sorts of things like this.
Yeah.
Now, people seem to think that no one's going to ever look at this and governments are going to keep turning a blind eye. But like every industry, that just takes time. And if you've got an immutable blockchain showing every transfer and record that you've ever done, and you're starting to buy a token that only has a use in buying drugs, then, well, you're asking to be looked
at. The feds might be on your case, mightn't they? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was very disappointed to discover that there is no anonymity to Bitcoin transactions, is there?
No, it's pseudonymous. It's private. Now, some of the implementations in wallets are problematic in that they decrease the privacy, but that doesn't mean that you can't be completely private. But private doesn't mean anonymous. And I studied a lot of Greek and Roman culture and philosophy early on in my sort of academic career. And I'm always one for a little bit of Aristotle, etc., which you've got your Ring of Gyges. Now, Ring of Gyges is the original before Lord of the Rings story thousands of years ago about a guy who finds a magical ring that allows him to become invisible. And without anything from society, without anyone being able to see what he does, slowly he changes. His attitude changes, and he knows that he can get away with anything. So he starts to rob and steal. He causes people injuries, knowing that he's totally above all the law and all the rest. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Yeah, up to a point. I mean, look, I take the view that drugs should be legalized. So certainly the weed and stuff. And I'm quite happy that I now live in a world where my kids, if they wanted to, can go onto the dark web and get dope sent to them by post, rather than having them to deal with a kind of, you know, a shady situation with a dealer. That seems to me a good development.
I would prefer to see basically no sort of criminal legislation against these things, but allow tort law and negligence rules from the past to apply, just like any other purchase. So if you buy weed and you sign off on the fact that you're getting a certain quality of weed and it's not, and you have problems later because of it, then you should be able to take action against the provider, the grower, the distributor. And if you find you're actually getting bath salts instead of whatever else, then you should be able to, or your family, take action. And I believe that would actually be more effective. Economics actually works.
But I think you can do that. I think you can buy escrow? Escrow? How do you pronounce it?
Escrow.
Escrow. And also, of course, you get the user recommendations, I understand, from people who've been using these sites. So, but like you, I have great...
But once again, you can't actually go to a court and sue a drug dealer for a bad quality product.
That is very true. I can tell you're a man economically after my heart. One of the things that initially excited me about cryptocurrencies was that... are you familiar with Dominic Frisby? Dominic was evangelical when he wrote his books about Bitcoin and about alternative economies and stuff. And I thought it was going to be the magical ring which freed us from the power of government, which stopped the banks having the financial sector having its control over us. But it hasn't quite happened, has it?
There is no magical ring, I'm sorry. I know people love to think this, but the reality is, if you think about society, people are always going to want credit because, well, there's that holiday that I want now that I couldn't be bothered saving for. And they're always going to do things that they shouldn't do. What we really need to be thinking about is how we develop as a society. And Greeks and Romans had an idea of what made you a citizen. And it wasn't about big government or anything like this. It was about a particular type of attitude. If you wanted to actually be involved in society and be a citizen, then you had to be involved.
Yes, there's a book I'm gonna. I keep mentioning it in all my podcasts, but it's so good. Have you heard of Richard Legutko? He's a Polish academic.
MEP. No, I haven't actually. Sorry,
but he talks in this book about the failure of liberal democracy. And he mentions the Romans and the Republic as a kind of the perfect mix of aristocracy, oligarchy, and democracy, because they're all flawed in their ways, and you need
exactly.
That
kind of... And personally, I see one of the big issues is the birth of the welfare state, because in the past, before the 30s, before all of this became large, there were safety nets. There were sort of mutual co-ops, and there were lodges and friendly societies. Now, where people say that this is a problem is you had to go to them and you had to feel bad about asking for money. But why is that a problem? If you're down on your luck and you have to ask, then you shouldn't feel good about it. You should want to work, want to strive to get out of that sense of shame. And I know many people will look at this badly, but you shouldn't love being unemployed. You shouldn't love being living off the backs of other people.
Yeah, that's quite Randian of you. Are you an Ayn Rand fan?
I've read all of her works. Yeah. I don't know if I'd put myself in any one box.
Yeah.
I believe in economics, and it's rather hard to be a dogmatic supporter of anything if you're going to be scientific in principle and review things based on their actual merits.
It's very interesting what you say about the way we've been encouraged now to look at the phrase the deserving poor as a horrible concept, which shows just how ghastly the Victorians were, that they were capable of judging between poor who deserve welfare and those who are just kind of lazy scroungers. And it, this goes back earlier, doesn't it, to the concept of sturdy beggars. But I think maybe we should revive that concept.
Yeah, I don't disagree. There are a lot of people in this world, and what we seem to forget is the jingoistic nationalist idea of these are my people and my little tribe. It has to really change. We need to think that this is a global world, and it's going to become more global with technology. And why are people here more deserving if they're not willing to be doing everything that citizenship requires than someone in Nigeria or the Congo or Central South America or wherever else? I mean, we're all humans.
So what? So you'd be arguing actually for a greater share of our GDP going towards...
Not at all.
Not the Ethiopian Spice Girls and the other things that, that apparently our foreign aid budget has been spent on.
No, I'd be opening up trade. I'd be enabling these people to trade with us.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose... slightly analogous to the rise of cryptocurrencies is the way that in countries like Kenya, they use mobile phone transfers, don't they?
M-Pesa, etc.
Which is just... Where did that come from, by the way?
That came from a concept where people started selling phone time. Because they had prepaid time, people started selling the amount of time that they had on their phones. And because it had value as sort of use... people could actually put a value against it. They all had a common way of doing trade and transfer, and they could do it remotely over distance.
Isn't economics wonderful? Aren't markets wonderful? Economics isn't wonderful. It's just a study of markets. But
I think both are, and I think they're both essential. Unfortunately, we got a lot of people who call themselves economists now that aren't. I mean, even now we get ones like Paul Krugman win Nobel Prizes, and I'd actually call him not an economist.
Yeah, I'm with you. Why would you call him not an economist?
For the first part, he's very unscientific about his processes. Not in that we need numbers or anything like that, but he seems to make up things as he goes. I mean, if you look at what he says it in a very Keynesian manner. It's just incomprehensible enough that he can get away with not being called a liar, but sort of messy enough that he can say the exact opposite thing like a year later. And if he gets pulled out about it, he says, no, I really meant this.
Yeah, I'm definitely not in the Paul Krugman fan club either. The next section we're going to talk about how it all happened, and you're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special and exciting and really quite interesting, I think you'll agree, guest, Craig Wright. More in a moment.
Breitbart News Tonight with Joel Pollack and Rebecca Mansour.
The real thing that the left is angry about is they're like, how could you allow these Russian memes? Somebody saw a meme and then they decided they had to vote for Trump. Or it must have been fake news. And by fake news, they mean conservative websites. Come on. But this is what the left thinks. Fake news. And by fake news, what they mean is shut down Breitbart.
Breitbart News Tonight. Weeknights starting at 9 p.m. East on Sirius XM Patriot 125.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Craig Wright, chief scientist at Enchain. And early, I mean, you wouldn't call yourself the inventor of Bitcoin, would you?
I would say I'm going to try and keep the little bit of privacy I have left in my life.
Yeah.
But I've been there since the beginning.
Right. Okay. So that means you went from when you were creating Bitcoin, were you thinking this is going to make me bloody rich?
That wasn't really what I was thinking. When you're creating any successful sort of company, invention, whatever else, you're not sitting there going, this will make me rich. So in the development of any of my companies in the past or any of my developments in the past, you're not concentrating on that. You're concentrating, it's a passion for the thing you're building and creating. Yeah. And even now with my organization with Enchain, I mean, the few people at the conference saying, when you're young, you're passionate about things.
Yeah.
You don't need to lose that spark. Even if you fail, even if you go down, the key to success is learning from that failure and just continuing to build. I mean, I had my first listed company when I was 29, and that ended up because of the dot-com crash and all the rest, even though we were trying to be profitable. All our clients lost money, and then with Enron, Andersons, which was a client of mine at the time, disappeared, a whole lot of other things. And you learn from your failures, and you don't give up. You look at how we can do that better next time and how you can build something bigger and better next time, and that's what's important.
So you'd had a company which was going places, and then it collapsed because of the financial climate.
I've done that a few times.
Oh right, okay. And when you were working on Bitcoin, was there a bunch of you sort of working together on it, or was it? I don't know how it works.
I don't really talk about the earliest days of Bitcoin at the moment, but. For many different reasons.
Right.
But in 2009, there were a few key people that were very interested in this. Bear, Hal Finney, and a few others. A friend of mine who's now dead, Dave Kleiman, many others out there. And it wasn't the same atmosphere as sort of came in about 2012. This was when it was a passion for creating something, which is what I see missing from a lot of the industry right now. Now it's about how do we create something to pump, dump, and get out. It's a lot of people are just there, not for the technology, not for what they can do to change the world, but because they think they deserve a quick buck. And I've even had people come up to me and go, it's all fine for you, you've got money now, what about us?
Well, right.
Put the time in, build something. Every invention that can be invented hasn't been yet.
And so that 2009 was when you would have been quite old. I mean, you weren't in your 20s, were you? How old were you?
2009. I was born in 1970, so
okay, so you were 39.
I was 39.
Yeah, okay. So you were approaching middle age. And when was the point where you'd done all this kind of clever technical stuff? When was the time when it started taking off financially for you?
Oh, not for years. 2009, I was way in the hole. I'd taken a golden handshake, so to speak, from BDO. I was working at an accounting firm, and with the downturn in the market and everything like that, they offered basically money to get rid of people. I was on partner track at the time, and I took the money and ran. And then I started a few companies in early 2009 to do with security and Bitcoin and other such things. And basically, I was about negative 1.1 million at one stage. I had a farm that I mortgaged, other things like this. Went way into the hole at that point, and came close to facing bankruptcy twice during that period, because I think even when it started selling in 2010, Bitcoin was originally going for like 0.003 cents per Bitcoin. So
I wish I'd bought in then.
Everyone does. And held and
and hodl. Yeah, exactly. So and you were married at this time, and you had kids?
Yes, I was married until I started this, and then I got divorced, and I've been remarried. So, I'm on my second marriage now.
Right. So do you think your first marriage collapsed because of the precariousness of your existence?
Probably in part. Yeah. I mean, being an entrepreneur is always precarious.
Yeah. And so your children have known a period where were you depressed at this time or?
I wasn't depressed. I mean, I've been used to it, and I've seen all this. Probably the first time I saw something fail, I was for a little while, but you get over it and you get back on your feet and you keep going.
Right. And so you presumably built up quite a holding of Bitcoins for yourself.
One or two.
Did you start thinking, well, the price has reached a certain point, it's not going to go any higher, I better start liquidating them now? Or did you think, no, it's going to go... Did you know it was going to go to 20,000 last year?
In time it will. I think that part is a bubble. There was a fork, Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin Cash.
Yeah.
And I'm now sort of promoting what is the original Bitcoin, which is Bitcoin Cash.
Right.
Now, the value there is too much in both of them for what it really is. Not because of the future, but because of pure speculation. And can it be worth more than that? Definitely, much more. But I think people jump in too early and too fast. So it's not that it won't go up more, but part of the problem is people don't know which branch of Bitcoin, which applications, whatever else. So,
right, okay. So what you're basically recommending is buy Bitcoin Cash rather than Bitcoin.
I'd actually recommend people use Bitcoin Cash.
Right.
I'm a shovels type of guy. I believe if you want to get wealthy, don't just buy and hold Bitcoin. Build something. Build an industry. Build a corporation. Build something that actually uses the technology and takes it further. That's where you're going to actually find real wealth.
Yeah, some of us don't have tech skills, all right, Craig? You know, some of us, I couldn't have, you know, even if you'd given me 100,000 years, I still couldn't have created blockchain technology or anything else. You know, some of us, I can just write.
But then find a way of getting out to a larger audience and maybe monetize that. So with one of the companies we've invested in is yours, and they've released Money Button, and that allows you to have a WordPress-type site or even a podcast and monetize it.
That's, now you're talking. That's really not a bad idea, is it?
Mm.
Going back to your Michael Jordan.
Much better than ads.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Because presumably it frees you from this, one of the main problems that my industry has at the moment, which is that Silicon Valley is trying to censor voices like mine.
Exactly.
And so just tell me a bit more about how this would work, how we can get past this politicization of the internet.
So imagine you set up your own website,
yeah,
and you put a little button on there that allows you to put your podcast up there and charge people 2 cents to watch it,
yes,
or listen to it. And you get a large audience because you're actually someone who people want to listen to.
Yeah.
And to do that, they pay you 2 cents a week. And maybe you manage to get 1 million followers. And those 1 million followers now, rather than having to watch ads and wait for that silly little thing and then click through to actually hear you, get to listen straight away or save your podcast or listen however they want.
Yes.
And yes, it's only 2 cents, but multiply that by 50 podcasts a year for 1 million people and you're quite wealthy.
Oh, am I? Oh, good. I'm glad to hear this. Because I wasn't doing the maths there. Presumably you were, because you've probably got a maths brain. And what currency are they paying me in? Are they paying me in Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash? Or
they can pay in Bitcoin as the back end, but they could also choose a currency. So something like Money Button will allow you to choose an amount you want to charge, such US dollars or pence or something like this.
Right. Does Money Button exist already?
It does.
Okay. So why isn't it not more of a thing?
It's fairly new. Ryan's only just released it in the last couple of months.
Oh, I see. So we're quite bleeding edge in this.
We are very bleeding edge in all this. That's great. I mean, this is the whole point. We should be further ahead, but too many people have been just speculating on Bitcoin and flipping it back and forwards for other cryptocurrencies rather than building the infrastructure that we need.
Right. Okay. So, but where does the money from the Money Button come from? Is it from people's bank accounts, or do they have to own cryptos to make it work?
Basically, what happens is you have to own crypto, of course, but there'll be easier ways to onboard you. So buy £100 worth of Bitcoin, for instance, and then start using it.
Because it's certain at the moment, it is still a massive pain. buying and trading Bitcoin?
It is. It shouldn't be, but this is what I've been saying, with the industry needs to actually move not to this idea of using it as digital gold, but as real money. And real money needs to be simple.
Now, I kind of interrupted you on the most... I love Rags to Riches story. I absolutely love the fact that you grew up dirt. But I mean, just how poor were you? I mean, you really, really, really poor.
I had basically came from a family where I had a single mother, a pile of sisters is the only way to put it, lots of those.
Yeah. Do they still speak to you?
Occasionally. Yeah. Sometimes. They're all still in Australia, although my one of my sisters sort of flits back all over the place. We were lived on the wrong side of the tracks, right next to the train station at one part of our life, above a corner store. My bedroom was a hallway where my sisters, instead of walking around, would just walk over my bed.
Really? That is right. I mean, this is a rags to riches story. So Bitcoin got bigger and bigger, and you presumably sold little sort of piles of it here and there as over the years. Is that how it worked?
Fairly much, yes.
Yeah. And you had so many that you... Carry on.
Effectively, yes. I live way too much of a lavish lifestyle now. And yes, Bitcoin's gone up enough that I don't even make a dent in living that lifestyle.
That is amazing. And you mentioned on the way here that you said that for a time you tried to live as though you hadn't got money. And what put paid to that?
In Australia, I was living a sort of... It was a bit more surreal than that because, unfortunately, I still had the sports car, which I had... We lived in a suburban house, and there I had a sort of supercar in the driveway, which sort of... I think all the neighbours, because all the electricity we had in, I think half of them thought I must have been a drug dealer because maybe growing marijuana out the back or something. Because we'd had... for the computers I was running at home, I had sort of 300 amps of power put in, and
but this is so you could mine your... Were you mining yourself? Did you need to?
I was mining, but not at that stage.
Right.
That stage, I was running simulations and other such things on computers.
Right. So you had your supercar, and so that answers my first question I was going to ask, which is what was the luxury that you rewarded yourself with? That was the slippery slope.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah.
I've got a sort of passion for watches and cars and good restaurants.
Oh right, okay. You're not fat though or anything. You look pretty... How do you stop yourself going to pot when you've got all that?
Gym.
Right.
I basically have a gym at home, and I go down there and exercise when I'm home.
You don't have a personal trainer?
I do, and he comes over.
I was going to say, obviously you have a person.
Although I started paying him in Bitcoin, and he seems to disappear more these days. Every second week, he seems to be on holiday.
Oh, really? Oh, what? Because he too got in early enough for it to be...
Not quite, but anyway.
Oh, right, okay. So, but you now, you left Australia?
Yes, in 2015.
And why was that?
We left in after sort of doing a merger with another company in June of 2015 with the idea of moving over here to the UK because it's more of a financial hub. As nice as Australia is, it's in the middle of nowhere effectively. And we've built a fairly large research operation here in London. There are a lot more people who are available to hire. It's a financial hub. There are lots of people in Europe with backgrounds in economics, mathematics, physics, etc., that we can take. So,
right. I mean, I'm flattered, obviously, that you came to my country rather than America, which might have been the other option. Did you think about America?
I like New York, but I've got a history in gaming. Or gambling, rather, where I set up a number of online casinos, including Lassiter's, and I was involved with Bodog and Centrebet and things in the past. So I just, after a few of my friends having problems, I just don't trust America.
Oh, okay. What the regulatory environment?
Yes, that's correct. They're too fickle and they change.
Right. Yeah, I've always, it's one of the things that's puzzled me about America, that it is at once the land of the free and the land of really quite scary, heavy-handed regulation. You look at how the IRS comes down on you and stuff like that.
I don't even think America is really one country in a way. It's a whole lot of different areas. I mean, you've got California that is sort of divided into poor California and rich California, and they're completely different. Mm. You've got sort of the Midwest, the South like Texas, and then you've got the eastern states, and they're all completely different.
Yes. I like being in America. I like being with Americans. I've always had a very, very, very good time there. It's just the state that I don't like.
Mm, I agree. But it's also weird in some ways. I mean, I remember I visited upstate New York years ago, and I went to what was the biggest gun sort of store in the world.
Yeah.
And it was like a Walmart, but just guns. And one of the funniest things was there was this pink gun, like a Barbie type gun, 22 for children, for little
lovely
girls. So daddy and daughter could go out and shoot Bambi.
Do you know, if I'd lived in America, I would have bought my little girl a pink gun. I think that'd be pretty cool. I think you've got to love America for things like that. I mean, but look, I'm really glad that you have made all this money and you're not a bloody lefty like so many of them are.
Oh.
Why are so many of them lefties?
I think a lot of them come down to this idea that this is how they protect their money. If they seem to be the guy on top saying, everything's fair, you guys deserve more, then maybe they think that protects them. But it doesn't.
I've often wondered that about people like Zuckerberg. Did they start out as kind of grisly liberals or liberal lefties, or you reckon that they were possibly made that way? They probably move in the circles. You think about the circles people like Bill Gates moves in. They're all kind of these X-ray women who are on the board of museums and stuff, and they all imbibe these kind of progressive values, you think?
Oh, yes. I get myself into trouble quite a lot. My wife sort of berates me all the time because I'm told to shut up, basically, because we go out to functions and things. And I have this habit of opening my mouth and telling people what I think.
Well, can you not help save us? Because we on the right, in the loosest sense of the word, we need protection from the censorship and the censoriousness that we get from Silicon Valley. I mean, it's one of my biggest worries: the loss of freedom of speech, the fact that conservative arguments are being drowned out through censorship. So how can we deal with that?
Well, this is where building on top of Bitcoin will actually matter. So in the future, I'd like to see effectively not the internet as we have it now, this idea where people keep running around going that it's all about openness and socialism and all the rest. It was never about that. Bitcoin was built by companies. It was built by investment. It was built by research and development. It was built with patents. Most people don't even realize this because they're expired now. But SMTP was patented. So SendMail was covered by a number of patents. POP was the sort of protocol you use in the past for accessing email boxes. A lot of the internet protocol was actually patented, but because it was developed as far back as the 70s, all those patents are well expired. So people think that all of this happened freely and openly. It didn't. It happened because people could protect their intellectual property and knew that they had time to actually build something.
Yes. Do you think Tim Berners-Lee made a mistake by sort of giving it all away free?
Oh, definitely. Silly bugger. I mean, you can do many things and monetize without locking people out. And that's the balance that people have got to understand. If you want to make something that is really big and really important, then it needs to be low cost. So that doesn't mean free, but just low cost.
Yeah. And it is quite big now, so you could, even if you had sort of tiny, tiny, tiny micro fractions of,
exactly.
of a fee.
And that's one of the things that Bitcoin's going to be able to deliver. So when I mentioned the money button earlier, you could transfer to someone a fraction of a cent.
Yes. This was something that was being talked about 10 years ago. And I thought with my naive faith in the future, it would have happened by now.
Well, it has now.
Okay, it has now. So are you saying that, can I tick this off or cross this off my list of worries? That censorship and stuff, and are we going to be okay?
No, you can never tick it off your list. I mean, it's the old freedom is something that takes eternal vigilance. I mean, you can never tick off, it's okay, and just forget about it. To remain free, we actually have to always be incredibly vigilant. We have to watch. We have to engage. We have to actually be active in society. We have to report on what we see. Not the 1984 idea of Big Brother or anything like this, but as citizens, as people involved in our own communities, as people part of a society.
Yes. No. I'm glad that you're saying this stuff. Is there a big boys club that you kind of hang out in? I mean, do you see Peter Thiel for I don't know, kite surfing sessions or whatever it is that multi-millionaires do?
No. Funny story. I was at a conference hosted by Cisco over a decade ago now, and I'd actually selected that conference because it got me into a building where Peter Thiel was going to be, and I managed to wrangle a sort of 20-second elevator pitch, literally in an elevator, and I was dressed like I was now, and I'm in a three-piece suit, and I sort of started talking to him, and he said, excuse me, real engineers don't wear suits, and walked off.
No. Oh, my God. Are you richer than Peter Thiel?
I've no idea.
Because is it not true that however rich you are, you could never be rich enough, because there's always somebody richer than you, and you're always looking upstairs and thinking.
If that's what your aim is, then I guess. I mean, that's the old Getty movie bit, how much is enough, sort of more.
Right.
I don't think it's about that. It's what you can do and create. And, I enjoy my life now. I mean, I live in a nice big English country house.
Is it old or new?
It's newish.
It's not Volga Nouveau Riche house.
No, not so much.
It's James Bond.
No, it's not one of those types. It's an older style new.
Right.
So it's a sort of modern old, if that makes sense.
Well, what sort of neo-Georgian kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay. And have you got rolling acres?
No, I don't have rolling acres. We've got a little bit of a garden, but I don't have enough time to enjoy the little bit I've got.
Yeah, but you pay gardeners too. I mean,
I already do that.
Oh, have you got a bit? Because my wife is a gardening editor of Country Life, and so she spends a lot of time going around rich people's. I mean, it's where the entire gardening industry is bankrolled by very, very rich people who can afford 10 or 15 gardeners to...
Yes, we have nice gardens. That's and all great. The rest for what we've got. Even grow vegetables.
Have you got a walled garden? I hope you've got a walled garden.
I've got the espalier fruit.
A what?
Where you put fruit against the wall.
Oh my God, I've suddenly remembered the amazing thing you said this morning, and I while it's still in my brain, you were talking about the things that blockchain technology can do. And tell me about the niche food stuff thing that you can do.
Okay, so I still own a ranch, but it's now leased out because I'm not back in Australia. But I used to actually work from a cattle ranch and farm in Australia years ago. So gardening and the land is sort of at heart of part of what I love. And one difference I see is technology making this more effective. I mean, if you look here, even in England, you go out to the outskirts of many cities and there's lots of old buildings that are basically run down and wasted and underutilized. With LEDs and more efficient lighting now and other such things, you can actually start having full spectrum lighting for plants and control exactly the amount of light, the amount of CO2 in sealed environments and all sorts of things. And no pesticides, no water problem because of recycling. And I see a world where instead of having all our vegetables taken all over the place, we could have localized high-tech greenhouses. And now using AI, not with the Terminator type scenario, yeah, but more imagine capturing all the data as we do already. And the example I gave during the panel was, imagine that you'd gone to Sicily in the year 2006 and you had some aubergine, some eggplant, and it was the most amazing tasting eggplant or the most amazing tomato or something like that that you'd ever tried. Yeah. You could actually order that particular type of heritage vegetable, and they could grow it exactly the same way. They could have the same lighting as was back then at that time, the same atmosphere, the same temperatures, guaranteeing that that particular thing that you remember, you have delivered as close to possible as you remember. So we could sell all the data about the environment and make that into a smart contract. We could have the full growing cycle so that you can monitor your vegetables, see how they're going, know that in 6 weeks' time, this is going to be delivered.
We're just going to become so sybaritic, aren't we? But how are we going to, given that the machines are all going to do our work for us, how are we going to earn money to pay for all these kind of services?
This is where people go wrong. Machines don't take over. It becomes a more symbiotic relationship. So if we remember, Kasparov was beaten by IBM's computers, and then he came back and beat it and et cetera, and things kept going back and forwards for a while. But the way that it's actually migrated is people and computers working together. And when you have human ingenuity and computer ability to number crunch, you get something remarkable. So better chess players, better Go players, better whatever else. The options that the machine gives you about things you hadn't thought about or had forgotten or not remembered, coupled with our abilities. We do things that machines can't do. Machines do things we can't do. So forget this singularity idea that all these idiots over in Silicon Valley keep selling. It's more of a symbiosis, a world where instead of having to remember everything, it's there on hand. A world where we can bring back memories on command, where we can search data and think of new things. So I actually see what we need is more of an old style education. I mean, I've been through many degrees, and the one thing that disappoints me more than anything else is we have great technical education in some areas, but we don't teach people to think. We don't teach people the classics. We don't teach people what university used to be about. And everyone says that's old and dead, but the idea of Socratic education, of learning Roman history, of the past, of why.
I'm so totally with you. You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Dr. Craig Wright. More in a moment.
Sunny's Corner with Sunny Johnson.
Everything in hip-hop is not bad. Kanye agreed with us, so let's love him today until he raps tomorrow and you turn your back. Because if you jump off when the fun of the moment is over, then you are in fact making Kanye the token he is accused of being. So please, don't do that. Don't go there.
Sunny's Corner with Sunny Johnson. Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. East on Sirius XM Patriot 125.
This is Dellingpole, a Breitbart.com podcast. Here once again is James Dellingpole.
Welcome back to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special guest, Craig Wright, who is the chief scientist at Enchain. Surely you must be some... Doesn't having your sort of wealth and success buy you a place at some top table somewhere? Is there a kind of a free market equivalent of Bilderberg? Is there a kind of sinister organization of people from our side of the argument that where we conspire to make the world a better place?
Oh, I haven't found out about it yet. No one's giving me the special handshake, but I know a few people with lots of money, but most of those are sort of weird, wacky guys like me. So I guess we all get put on the fringe and ignored by those who go to arts festivals and things like that. I remember I went to a Hollywood thing years ago because my sister was working as a producer, and I'm never getting invited back to one of those because someone came up to me and I sort of said, who the hell are you? And it was some famous actress, but just expected that I'd know her. So.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah. Well, had you had the chance to open your mouth and treat her to your politics, I suspect that you'd have been even less popular. So maybe it's just...
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, I'm very, very glad that you exist. And I totally agree with you about this education thing. I mean, surely, as we have more time on our hands, we're going to, aren't we? Is that one of the things we're going to get in the future?
Depends. We'll have more time for a certain people and less for others. Unfortunately, for a lot of people with very little education, they're going to find that they're going to have to work harder. But that doesn't mean that you have to be smart. And there are many people out there who academically aren't smart, but they try and they learn and they do many things. I knew a guy in Sydney who had made a little empire. He was worth probably about $24 million a decade ago, and he did that through garbage. Not that people want to talk about these things, but that's what he did. He found a new way of collecting garbage from restaurants and other such things and built up a company doing that, and is quite successful. And even in the past, there was a Roman emperor whose money was made from basically piss.
Really? From ammonia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right.
So there are lots of little things that we don't like to talk about, and we say, nouveau riche or whatever else, and forget that these are all things that are valuable to society.
No, I'm sure that there will always be roots out of poverty for you or people like you or for piss sellers or whatever. But what about the ordinary mass of humanity who haven't gone to college, lucky people, because they haven't been indoctrinated by left-wing bullshit. But what's going to happen to them in the future? Sort of manual labourers. How are they going to make ends meet?
They're going to have to think of new things and even manual labourers can think of different ways of doing things. Our real sort of thing that is actually valuable as humans is our mind. So, I mean, unfortunately, if you move away from that, that's where you're going to have problems. I mean, people say you can't automate certain things, but there's a machine that does paving now. There's a robot that lays paving stones better than humans do. There are digital printers for all sorts of things. So you don't need to be super smart necessarily. You need to use what you see and have a little bit of optimism and believe that you can change something. I mean, there's a silly thing as a different idea that came from Australia that was patented and made millions of dollars, which people say shouldn't have had a patent because it's so simple. It was basically a lump of concrete with two holes in it. The two holes were the width of a forklift prong and were lined with steel to guide the forklift in. And the whole idea was someone who couldn't afford a compressor could lower that into their industrial bin and it would fit perfectly and crush all the stuff inside the industrial bin, allowing them to save on their garbage removal.
Right.
And that's not something that many people in universities would think about. It's something that someone who lives a normal average life thinks about.
Yeah.
And it made millions.
Yeah. I can see that you cannot resist always thinking of clever ways of making money. I mean, that's obviously how you were born.
Yes, and that's the problem right now. The welfare state stops people thinking that way. It makes you, instead of thinking how you can actually do something to get out of poverty, it you start thinking, what am I due?
Right. Do you talk about this stuff on panels and things, or do you have quite a low profile life?
It's been low profile. It's becoming less and less so. I'm realizing that if I want to try and steer some of this into where it needs to go and get people to understand that Bitcoin is capitalist, that I have to actually speak up because no one else will.
No, I just kind of feel I've lucked out by the accident of fate that led me to be on a panel that led me to meet you, because it was completely random, this meeting, wasn't it? It wasn't like...
Yes, I mean, until 2015, I stayed a completely low profile and tried to stay out of everything. A couple of videos and podcasts that everyone ignored, and academic papers that no one reads. But unfortunately, as I said, the only way I think I'm going to actually get the world to understand the benefits of something like Bitcoin is to actually go out there and sell it myself, because everyone else is telling you that it's going to be a crypto utopia, that socialism is going to rule and everyone will be equal, and that's just not right.
Right, I'm with you there. You mentioned something earlier I found very interesting. You said that it's really... there are problems with being super rich, that it creates challenges. Tell me about some of those.
Oh, they're not things that sort of are really worth whining about, but no. It's an interesting journey. I mean, it's not something you can sit there and stand in front of people and go, poor me. I mean, but you start to realize that things are different. We now have like a home office function, so to speak, and I have people who work for me globally, personally, who manage some of our finances and things like that. And you, even with a lot of money, you have to have some trust, because even if you protect most of it, there's always bits that people can take. And
yes, and people, I imagine, are always after something that...
Yes, you always got people asking for money, asking for Bitcoin, asking, why don't you invest in my X or Y, or why haven't you got back to me? You said you'd do this and it's been weeks. Why haven't you given me this yet?
Yes. There is a company I'm thinking that needs to be created called Dellingpole Inc. And it's a really good investment opportunity, I think, for canny investors. So do you... does it make you harder as a person?
It makes you more cynical. You have a different view of life, reality, and people. I mean, you see them differently. An example would be, I mean, we were having sort of a lunch and things at home, and my wife, get her in trouble here, was saying how... all our friends and everything like that are fine, nothing special. I'm going, yes, dear, but they're all 1%. And she's going, yes, but I hang out with lots of people. And I go, yes, dear, but they're all still the 1%. And she's going, yeah, but such and such is just an employee. And I went, yes, he's one of the CEOs at Shell in Europe. And she went, yeah, but he's down to earth. And I went, yes, dear, because we're all hanging out as sort of people who are all similar. And
right. Yeah.
And I mean, that's the thing. You end up like everyone else, forming cliques that are alike. I try and get out to see people in different aspects of society and whatever else. And unfortunately, it becomes harder. If people recognize you, and I've been recognized at airports and things like that now, because of crypto area. And the more they recognize you, the harder it becomes. So you can't just walk around, and you can, I guess, put in glasses and funny hats and do all that stuff, but it changes you.
Do you sort of feel obliged as a public figure to be kind of nice, likable, or?
To put it quite frankly, fuck no. I annoy the buggery out of people because I refuse to be.
Right.
I'm Australian, and according to the Australian court, the word fuck is not actually offensive because we're Australians.
That, I think, the similar rule applies in Ireland as well, where they say feck And apparently it just completely lets them off the hook. Whereas you can't say it in America because they're quite, you know, the Pilgrim Fathers and all that.
All the people they didn't want, they sent to Australia. And all the ones who were sort of a bit too up themselves, they sent to America.
Now, this is a technical question, which I think is of any interest to people, those of us who've at some stage in their lives have held Bitcoin. But when you've got loads, how do you sell it?
I sell it on an exchange like anyone else, sometimes over the counter transactions. I don't sell a lot. I mean, I could live way less modestly than I do now, which is not modest at all. I've still got a wife to deal with, and she limits what I'm allowed to buy.
Right. So you mentioned watches, and you mentioned sport. Have you got a sports car collection?
I've got a very small collection, yes.
Okay, so, you've got what, a McLaren?
No, I'm trying to convince the wife I should have a McLaren, but I've got a Lamborghini Aventador, got a few BMWs, I had a Jag.
What kind of Jag?
The sort of little F-type.
Do you not think you ought to have a D-type? Do you not like that old?
I have in the past, but I don't have the time to maintain it.
But that's what you pay your people for. Now, here I am trying to tell you how to be rich.
I know, but I actually, if it's an old car, I actually did my mechanics certificate in Australia, and I like working on them.
Oh, dear.
And if it's a new one, they're too boring. You plug in a machine and it tells you whatever, and you replace something. But old ones, you had to actually adjust carburetors, you had to play with screws, you had to muck around.
Yeah.
And if I had an old car again, I'd waste too much time.
Right. And obviously, you fly by private jet everywhere?
Not everywhere, no.
Sometimes it's better to take fly commercial first class.
Mm.
Right. And I think this is almost going to be my final question. What was the moment when you went, fuck, I'm seriously rich? Was there a thing that made you brought it all home to you?
What was that moment? Unfortunately, I'd probably like to say no, but yes, there is. If I'm going to be honest, realizing that I'm worth more than $1 billion US, that you're in a horribly wealthy type environment, that you can do what you want and build what you want, that you could never work again, and that would be completely, utterly boring, that you're going to have to fight temptation not to fall into that trap, which is something I don't think people think about. It's actually very tempting. I mean, my wife and family, we went around, did the Greek island bit on the yacht type thing earlier this year.
Yeah.
And it's amazingly tempting to think that you can just sit there and float around and do nothing, although I did actually work on the top of the yacht as everyone else was sort of partying, but I can't help that.
that you see, you're talking my language. I would like to be doing that. I mean, obviously, I don't want to stop working, but I do quite like the idea of touring Greek islands on a private yacht with the private chef. That's got to be good. I bet that's one of the great perks, isn't it?
Yes, and I actually, I'm still getting rid of the weight. So yes, I got the gym at home, but in that little bit of time, I put on too much weight, too much alcohol, too many going out.
And when you see another yacht cruising these islands, do you sort of suss it out and say, my yacht's bigger than your yacht?
No, I'm quite happy, and I'd have to convince the wife of other things for that.
Because it's not often I don't think generally podcasters get to meet mega, mega, mega rich people. I mean, I had dinner once with Gina Reinhardt.
Mm-hmm.
I like Gina. Have you met her?
No, but I know all about her.
I mean, she's got to be loads richer than you, hasn't she?
I'm not sure what the exchange rates are now.
Oh, I see. So you might be in the same league. Because Gina Reinhardt, seriously rich. Mm. Yeah. And have you become nicer to... Do you feel honor bound to be extra nice to the little people? Like, so are you generous with your tips and you're kind of looking after kind of?
Oh, I always believe you should tip if there's good service. You don't just give away money for nothing, but if there's good service, then you reward people for it.
But you don't over tip.
Oh yeah, I over tip all the time.
Because that must be quite difficult when you're so rich that like money's almost lost its meaning. So it's quite hard. Rather than having to think about what is the correct market rate, you'd rather err on the side of excess.
Fairly much.
Yeah. And how...
If it's a good meal and if it's good service, yes.
And how do you stop your... I'm now bracking my brakes because I know that my special listening friend who listens to this podcast loyally is going to be thinking, why didn't you ask him this? How do you stop your children turning into horrible little wankers?
Luckily, they grew up experiencing the times when we ate cheap meat and beans and told them it was healthy.
Yeah.
And lived in a, well, any way to put it, shitty little place that should have been torn down.
Right.
And a few things like that. And they still remember it. It's not the kids that we worry about. It's the grandchildren when they finally come. That hopefully nowhere near now, but that'll just make it worse.
Do you know the scariest thing of all? And I don't know whether you can work out a solution to this. What's going to happen when some little tosser, possibly a grandchild, sets up the foundation and starts giving it to these crappy liberal progressive causes and undermines all your good work and destroys everything you stood for?
I know, that's always something to think about. I mean, Reinhardt's been going through that herself with her her children, and they're all trying to grab their grandfather's money and force
and spend it on crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They don't want to be part of the business. They don't want to build the business. That's what people don't get. It's not, hey, I've got this pile of money. You build a business and you build something. So, for instance, with Enchain, we're building a research development house. We're developing new technology that some of it won't be viable commercially for 5 or 10 years, but we're still doing that, knowing the future's what we're aiming for. And you hope that that will continue. You don't want to see it like many other industries where someone later on tears it apart.
Yeah. Well, look at the Rockefeller Foundation. Look at all these. They're all...
Vanderbilts, Rockefellers, yeah, all of them.
Well, let's hope that your foundation carries on speaking up for free markets and personal responsibility, all the things.
And we don't have grandchildren that sit there going, that horrible old man who only cared about money.
Yeah, exactly. That was really interesting, Craig. Thank you very much. You're listening to the Dellingpole podcast with me, James Dellingpole, and my very special surprise guest, and I think he's paid dividends, literally as well as metaphorically, Craig Wright, Chief Scientist at Enchain.
Breitbart News Daily with Alex Marlow.
Why did we see some of the Republican... kissing of Mark Zuckerberg that was taking place?
I called it kissing the ring because I felt like every single person practically had to kiss the ring of this guy, you know, who wants to do nothing except get all those people out of office. So, you know, bizarre behavior from the Republicans.
Breitbart News Daily, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern on Sirius XM Patriot 125.